Good evening, everybody. I'm Frank Chaichiri from Seattle Transit Blog.
I'm successful Oscar host Martin H. Duke.
I don't know, man. It was successful in the media, but not one of the best nights for ratings.
I don't even know.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking the the So Distillery whiskey that will not be named until they pay for a sponsorship. Ah,
fair enough.
Hey, back to cocktails?
No. Well, I'm having a Pike Monk's Ale, Pike Brewing Company, Belgian Triple. It's pretty good.
Another local company that could sponsor us.
There you go, man. There's lots of opportunities. We'll have to get them wrapped in when the Center City Connector opens. We'll do a big party at the Pike Market.
There you go.
Around there. So, big tie-in.
Okay. We have a relatively slow news fortnight, but we also, in anticipation of that, we also asked for questions from the group, and we got a lot of good ones. So we'll spend some, we're unfortunately under a time constraint tonight, but we'll get to as many as we can. You might save some more for next time. So let's just start off then. So you wrote an interesting piece about expensive land.
Yes.
And how that's feeding into house prices. Would you like to?
Yeah, I mean, I can summarize that for people who haven't read it or don't have it in front of them. I mean, basically, this was just a link to, I thought it was an interesting take on, I really enjoyed this blog, City Observatory, that's this Daniel K. Hertz and a couple of other people have been writing. I think he's out of Chicago. But they've been writing really good stuff recently on land use and density. And I kind of just, every time I want to write something, I just want to like point people at them and just say, go read them, because they're just making a ton of sense. And one of the things that I think that I really like about the way they framed this piece, this was an article about the cost of, or a blog post about the cost of land and leading to the price of housing. Basically, you have two inputs to the cost of a house, right? You've got the cost of the land, and then you've got the cost of the house itself, the improvements upon that land. And in most cities, the driving cost is the land itself, because the housing materials are relatively cheap by comparison. Now, you get into some issues when you get into really tall buildings where the actual cost of construction starts to go up as you exceed a certain height, right? But for the most part, so what happens is, what you can do with a given piece of land is constrained by the amount of money you have to pay for the land itself, and in terms of how expensive the housing that's going to go on top of that is going to be. And it doesn't really, like I said, it doesn't always help to just like, well, we'll just build up, because you run into these other issues of construction costs. But the other thing that he said that I thought was an interesting way of framing it from a transit perspective was, you know, cities are kind of built out to their maximum size in some way, and because a city needs to be constrained in such a way that that you can reasonably commute from one side of the city to the other, and so that kind of puts a natural scale on the size of the city. Now, that can be bigger or smaller. A city that's very auto oriented can have a very low population but still hit that number, you know, whereas a city like Tokyo can, you know, scale to 30 million people or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the point being is that you can't, people are only accept a certain amount of time commuting, which means that you can't just kind of build cheap bungalows out into the suburbs anymore. You have to do infill. And when you have to do infill, you end up spending more money for land, and you have to build more densely, et cetera, et cetera. And with regards to Seattle, we have, you know, very little land that's actually available for more development. I mean, you just think about the fact that 65% of the city is zoned for single family. Of the other 35%, some percentage of it is already built out. Some percentage of it is office and industrial and commercial. You know, what's left over to build is a very small fraction of the overall city's land. And so that ends up getting bid up and being very expensive, and therefore costing a lot of money.
So I thought everything in that piece was correct. And yet I was still grumpy. And it's not fair, because I think I'm grumpy at a lot of people in this debate. I think that something about the mayor's comments about Hala have put me off. And it goes back to something it took me a while to figure out what the problem was, but it goes back to a post I wrote a few months ago, actually, that I think talking about affordability is just wrong, and it's wrong in a way that is messing up our entire debate and understanding of the problem. Hmm. In that, affordable housing is a symptom of the root cause, which is a housing shortage.
Right.
And I think that matters because we have all these debates about, well, we're going to build this housing, but it's going to be luxury housing, so it doesn't solve anything. Or they want to build 80 new luxury housing units to replace 3 affordable housing units. So that's bad, isn't it? And I went around with this with Lisa Herbold before she ran. I had an exchange of guest post and blog post before the election that kind of went down this line. So I think we talked about it even on the pod. So
yeah,
we don't need to go through that again. But I think I think the failure to really use the proper vocabulary leads to these debates that we wouldn't have if it was properly understood as a housing shortage issue.
Mm-hmm. So what's the connection with the cost of land?
Well, just that. I think that's feeding into a discussion about affordability,
mm-hmm.
which is not, which again, I think is the wrong discussion.
It's getting us, it's painting us back into a rhetorical corner of talking about why housing is expensive, which is a debate that's not winnable.
Useful. Well, I think it's a debate that's not useful because it drives us to think incorrectly about the problem. And again, I think these objections you see about luxury units versus not luxury units, and there seems to be a assumption in the rhetoric that we have land we might be utilizing better, and the assumption that if it's going to something other than that quote unquote affordable housing, that somehow that's wasted. That if we have this little patch, we better use it for affordable housing, subsidized housing.
Right.
Or somehow we've squandered an opportunity. And, as I've also said before, absolutely there are certain segments of the housing market that can only be served with subsidized housing, so we have to build some. But at the same time, all segments of the market contribute to solving the problem.
Sure. I would buy that.
And maybe I'm shoehorning this orthogonal thing about land values into my hobby horse. Yeah.
No, I did get into the point of saying, of talking about affordable housing and kind of the what you get into this bad spiral with expensive land, which is that you say like, okay, land is really expensive and we want inclusive communities, so we're not content with putting all the low income housing way out in the periphery. We want people to be able to live in, who aren't rich, to live in nice neighborhoods. Therefore, we're going to try and buy a piece of property and put affordable housing on it. And then you end up spending, $1 million for a single apartment, mm-hmm. which is a direct outgrowth of the fact that, one, you have this laudable goal of trying to mix in, the community in terms of socioeconomic levels, but also you're waging a war in, because you have this housing shortage, which is, I think what your point is, like the root cause here is just we have this housing shortage, and that's what's driving up the cost of land in a lot of ways, right? Because there's so few houses close to job centers that land ends up getting expensive. And that is actually what's making affordable housing so expensive to build, right? So if we didn't have such a scarcity of housing close to job centers, we wouldn't have this problem of land values being so expensive, right?
Well, I think there's something to that. I think a piece of land that's only... I think when we have a real finite limit on number of units, then the fact that the land is the planning authorization to build or have a home on a piece of land is very valuable in itself. And in sort of this unregulated market where you could just build whatever you wanted, that regulatory rent would not be as high.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know if you have anything else to say about that. I wanted to talk a little bit about, ST3. So
yeah,
we had
go ahead.
Go ahead. You can.
Well, I'm just saying there were two reports that Zach made. One about early wins, which was a staff presentation responding to some neighborhood or city municipal input about what can we get specifically from Seattle, saying what can we get soon to kind of sweeten the pot for people that aren't patient. And furthermore, at the end of his ST3 comment letter period series, he talked about some various non-governmental organizations, kind of neighborhood groups and Microsoft and what have you, and what they said. Mm-hmm. And I want to sort of address those together because, you know, there was the normal kind of back and forth about, well, I want to, you know, light rail the Payne Field and this and that and infill stations and so on. And that's fine. But what I was kind of intrigued about is some of the projects that people are trying to attach to Sound Transit 3 because it is a very large funding source. I mean, in some cases, it's just moving things forward. I mean, I think a Graham station will be in an ST3 package regardless, but fast-tracking that has probably some fiscal planning implications. And then there's a bunch of other things that, strictly speaking, don't have to be in the Sound Transit budget. Things like TOD planning, which I read to be taking less than market rate for sales of land to encourage affordable housing. Various station access projects and so on. And I think all those things are laudable, but this has the whiff of something for nothing. Oh, and I'm sorry. And the other issue was that Seattle wanted to do a bunch of BRT improvements, including corridors where ST3 is eventually going to build rail. So just as a stopgap until rail is done to actually make lots of lane improvements, which would be great for SDOT's budget to have this ST pool. So there's a whiff of something for nothing. And if it really is something for nothing, I think all that stuff is great. But I wonder what opportunity costs there are in Sound Transit's budget if we were to do all these things. Does this mean, I mean, some of these projects are bigger than others. If we spend a few $100 million right away, does that impact things like bonding capacity so much that we can afford something like a Ballard UW subway line, which would be a big deal? Does it mean we have to half-ass some of the ST3 lines that we are going to do by cutting out stations that we really ought to have, like one at 99 and Harrison, for instance? Does it result in any delay? How much delay in a Ballard downtown light rail line is worth, you know, doing some significant BRT improvements? Mm-hmm. So I mean, at this point, there's no ST3 package, so it's very hard to really get a straight answer on what are the actual impacts of doing this, because there's no baseline.
Right.
But I sure hope that somebody like Rob Johnson or Ed Murray, I mean, Ed Murray's driving a lot of this early wind stuff, but I hope somebody like Rob Johnson, who also represents Seattle, really ask the question of staff and really ask them to really lay out what are the trade-offs in doing these early wins, in doing all these things that are certainly nice to have but are outside the core mission of putting high-capacity transit down for the next 100 years.
And the issue is twofold, right? One is these things are just Christmas ornaments on the tree that will weigh down. Are going to cost money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second issue is needing to do them in the short term means that you aren't able to build up your bonding capacity for when you need it in the long term, because the Sound Transit's plan is to basically collect bonds, and then slowly accrue sell bonds, and then slowly accrue the money they need when they really need to start, you know, operating a whole bunch of tunnel boring machines sometime in the 2020 timeframe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this hurts you kind of in both ends. One is it takes money off, and two, by siphoning off money at the beginning, it reduces potentially even more money down the road.
Yes. Well, I mean, on the other hand, you have inflation working in your favor if you do things early rather than late. So these things are complicated, and certainly in the case of, say, again, a project like Graham Street, which I think is in the cards anyway, it's not clear to me whether the relative fiscal impact of doing it now or in 2030. But certainly when a project was not likely to be in the package at all, and now we're adding it because it's, again, a big pot of money relative to a lot of these kinds of interests. I do sort of wonder how that's going to work out for us. And I hope that's not, I hope we don't blindly enter into these agreements to do these things, to buy off interest groups and incur all sorts of delays and other penalties and not really be aware of what we're doing.
Right. Well, this is, yeah, I mean, this is the classic Christmas tree kind of thing. Like I said earlier, it's, you know, everybody kind of wants to get their ornament on. I mean, basically what you're saying is Sound Transit ought to focus on building high capacity transit, and all this other stuff is nice to have, but that's not really the, that shouldn't be on their docket.
Well, I don't want to make that blanket statement, but Sound Transit is the only organization right. that can do that. And cities can help a lot with transit access.
Right.
Cities can certainly help with BRT lanes. Cities can help with TOD. And I'm reluctant to cut into a dedicated pot to do something that can only be done in that place right. to just sort of make it easier for SDOT to,
well, I mean,
to, and not to, you know, make its sums add up.
And not to be too annoying about it, but cities can also make transit-oriented development happen by allowing stations to be located in places that are amenable to transit-oriented development, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like, well, let's save money by, you know, building the light rail out next to the freeway. Oh, and then we need to spend some more money to actually build TOD because we can't actually build, nobody can walk to the station because we put it in the middle of a freeway interchange. But that's, I mean, that's obviously not true of every city, and certainly not every city that's asking for these kinds of things.
Certainly in Seattle, where I think they're excited about, well, right. not just TOD, but affordable housing, they actually are doing a good job of that.
What?
Because they're avoiding existing neighborhoods and going into, as we talked before, going into a lot of brownfields where you actually can do sui generis TOD.
Right, right. What do you think makes sense for what are they actually asking for in terms of interim BRT improvements? That seemed kind of vague to me. I mean, it sort of seemed like SDOT was basically saying, like, hey, can you buy us a big bucket of paint, red paint, that you can use to paint bus-only lanes
in Seattle? Well, we certainly like to be glib about paint, but, I mean, it is more involved with that, right? You're building stations, you're generally redoing streets, you're probably having some traffic calming measures, you're putting in curb bulbs. I mean, it's not anywhere near as expensive as a light rail tunnel.
Right.
But it's also like millions of dollars to right. do this properly. I mean, Move Seattle is mostly BRT type improvements, and it's a $1 billion package.
Right. Well,
so this is not you know, this won't completely suck up the Sound Transit budget, but it's not nothing.
No, it's going to be right. It's going to be something. So do you think that?
And we should say, like, for by means of comparison, tacking Ballard UW on, which I think would be a great project, on top of the things we're already going to do, would probably cost about $2 billion, give or take. So take you $500 million to make up a number that no one has provided from you know, to do BRT stuff that will eventually be obviated by light rail lines seems like a short-sighted thing to do.
I mean, that seems like a lot given what's in the Seattle Transit Master Plan for those corridors. I mean, it's yeah. on the order of the tens of millions, not the hundreds yeah. of millions.
Yeah. So that's true. That's true. That's a good point.
So
but
I,
then, yeah. But then again, so the other issue is so the somewhat harder issue is delay. You know, how many years are you willing to push back some of these big rail projects to put some bus lanes in early, because probably something that's on the order of $100 million, say, in total, will probably, if has to be spent right away, will probably affect timetables, I'd imagine, just for fund collection reasons, you would think. Again, this is speculation.
Yeah.
Because nobody, there's no, I mean, you can't go ask Sound Transit what is the impact of this, because they have no baseline package to weigh against.
Right.
But somebody needs to have some sort of alternatives analysis that says, with all the early wins and all the additional stuff, here's what the package looks like, here's what the timetable looks like. But if you don't do all that stuff, here's what those components look like.
Yeah. What? So the argument that Seattle made was basically saying to Sound Transit, look, what you've done in the past is you've set up this ST Express bus service as a interim, quote unquote, interim service until high capacity transit could be built. And there was some question with the light rail going all the way to Tacoma and Everett, would that then obviate the need for ST Express buses coming into Seattle? Because now we built light rail, you know, is it actually interim service or not? What is ST's goal with express bus service? And Seattle saying, well, if you guys are planning the, if express bus service is supposed to be interim service until an HCT corridor is built out, then we want some of that too. My question is, what was Sound Transit's capital investment in ST Express buses? Is it buying the buses? And I just general just ignorance on my part. Did they spend a lot of money on park and rides and other kind of facilities?
They did generally partner with WashDOT to build things like freeway access ramps.
Right.
So there's actually hundreds of millions of dollars sunk into the system. But I think the difference between what you're describing, the ST Express precedent in Seattle, is that you were giving things to people that were not going to get anything in that ballot measure. So in Sound Transit 1, you know, nothing was going to Pierce County, well, there were Sounder, but light rail wasn't going to get to Pierce County, or really very far into South King County. It wasn't going to go to the east side, wasn't going to go to Snohomish County, wasn't going to go on the 522 corridor. So, you know, you had to give them, you can't say, well, we're going to like just create this huge package and incur this tax and not provide any service right. other than maybe peak Sounder stuff. And then, right. you know, in ST2, there's a little bit less of that, but I think for tactical reasons, they decided to throw in some operations money, which, you know, may or may not have made a difference. I don't know. So it's not unprecedented to try to do something like that. But I think the logic of that is not completely transferable.
Fair enough. Did you want to say anything else on this ST3 stuff or the community?
No.
Okay. Then the other thing we wanted to talk about a little bit was the water taxi. So we've got yet another proposal for water taxis around the city. This is something that's been studied. The county has been studying this on and off for a while. They had a new round of studies, and they put together a couple of lines that they said were the quote-unquote most promising lines for potentially expanding the county's water taxi system to include some more routes. One of them is Kenmore UW. One of them is Kirkland UW. One of them is Ballard Downtown. And there's a new report out on this that Dan wrote up last week. Water taxis, they're the idea that won't die. That's so compelling, this idea that we have this water and we have boats. We really ought to be able to build a mass transit system on the cheap. And yet every time you actually do the math, it ends up not being very cheap.
Well, I don't think that's the reason. The reason is that there's a dedicated funding source where you can raise a tax for a ferry district. Right. And so this money is, quote, you know, in a certain bureaucratic mindset, that money is thrown away if you don't do anything with it.
Right.
So this got slayed, and rightfully so, for not being very productive for the reasons you've described. The waterfront tends to not be where the action is. This UW terminal is not terribly far. It's like across a parking lot from UW station. Mm-hmm. So that's not completely worthless. Mm-hmm. But it's got some issues. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea. I mean, I would absolutely agree that it is that there are better marginal uses of a dollar in the transit realm than to build these ferries. But I'm kind of struck by the fact that it's also a dedicated funding stream that you can't use for other things. So I think Dan's report said that this money can be used for ferries and buses that are meant to feed the ferries. So I tried to construct, and I did this in a comment. I'm not going to write a post about it because I'm not convinced I believe in it, but I think you construct a case for these. in that case is as follows. Number one, these ferries are going to be reliable. You know, this is kind of the same argument we've had about, you know, light rail to Tacoma versus Sounder to Tacoma. Well, Sounder's a bad example, but light rail to Tacoma versus bus to Tacoma. The fact is that this is fully dedicated right of way. It may be slightly slower, but it'll always be the same amount of time to get from port A to port B, unless there's some sort of weather issue that I don't know anything about boats, so I don't know. And then furthermore, to the extent that, I mean, given that one of these proposed terminals, I'm not going to defend Ballard to downtown Seattle. I think it's sort of silly. But in terms of the Lake Washington stuff, given that one of the terminals is on 522 and one is in downtown Kirkland, you could actually, if you squint hard enough, design a feeder bus service for those water taxis that also is really useful transit in itself. Mm-hmm. So if you manage to sort of cheap, this is a weird legal gyration, but if you were to sort of cheap out on the ferries themselves and really put a lot of emphasis on quote unquote feeder buses to it, you might actually be able to do constructive things with the bus service. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think Zach made a great point that from a carbon perspective, to the extent that we're doing this for climate change reasons, boats are actually much, much worse than buses are even driving. And I think that's certainly the case for car ferries. I don't know about foot ferries. Mm-hmm. But I believe in this context, needs some numbers to indicate that they were not good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah, I mean, the problem is with feeder bus service is that you're now introducing at least a two-seat ride, possibly a three-seat ride once you get to the other side, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really where things start to fall apart with a lot of these water taxi proposals. You just don't have the population kind of up against the waterfront that would make such a thing worthwhile. And you don't really have the choke points. I mean, honestly, like we've spent a lot of money and built a lot of infrastructure so that, you know, you may have heard there's now express toll lanes on 405 that can help Kirkland.
Well, for now, yeah.
you know, we spent a lot of time and effort like speeding up these commutes in other ways into UW or whatever. So it's just hard to see it being competitive. But I mean, I appreciate your willingness to kind of entertain the idea from at least a slightly contrarian perspective.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking to, I mean, I think one trap that some people get a little obsessed with sort of engineering cost per rider without any larger context, and money inefficiently spent that you couldn't spend otherwise is not actually money taking away from a more efficient transit use. Now, I mean, at some point you're concerned about the economic impact of taxes, and you might be concerned, depending on your theory of political science, you might be concerned that a new tax for a ferry district might somehow impair people's ability to vote for a more constructive transit tax. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it really works that way, but it's not a crazy thing to worry about. Mm-hmm. But it seems that this is not going to go anywhere. I believe this is a Rod Dombowski idea, mm-hmm. and Claudia Baducci, who's also on the King County Council, seemed pretty skeptical of it, and it got reamed in the Seattle Times pretty well.
Yeah.
So, well, with that, you know, and we weren't exactly thrilled about it. I don't know who's going to take the mantle of this thing, given all that static.
Yeah, I'd rather. Could you convince somebody that a gondola is actually a water taxi?
Well, if it was over water, maybe.
Maybe if it was, you know, I don't know. I mean, in general, this kind of falls into this. And Dombowski, I mean, I think he's a smart guy, but he's also one of these guys who, I don't know. I don't want to actually cast him specifically, but I think there is a certain class of politician who thinks that we can outsmart our way out of spending a lot of money on building transit infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And if we're just clever about it, and sometimes that's true. I mean, sometimes there are resources that are deployed inefficiently. But, you know, usually that means that's because there's some entrenched interest making them inefficient. And that's rarely kind of the way that this goes down is like, oh, well, let's, you know, let's figure out how to, you know, argue with the unions or something like that. It's like, no, let's, you know, let's find this, you know, find a clever solution like, you know, ferries. It sounds brilliant, but doesn't really pass the straight face test. But
that's also a category of frequent STB commenter. but yes, I don't know if that's what's driving this or if this is some sort of constituent service issue where he got a bunch of letters from somebody in Kenmore who wanted them to look at it. And, you know, I don't know that it really hurts to study it because I don't think it was, for the reasons I described, it wasn't just an intrinsically ridiculous idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you have the ferry district, you should figure out if it's worth using mm-hmm. the taxing authority. Let's go to some of our listener comments. We got a whole bunch of comments here.
There were great questions in many respects. So I say we just do you have the post open?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no, but so I'm not open. Go ahead.
I just say we just go down the line, and if we have anything intelligent to say about it, we'll talk about it. And if not, we won't. We'll do this chronological order. So the people who posted first are the ones that are most likely to make it in our little time window here. So the first comment was from the Overhead Wire. He asked about Roger Millar, who's the acting WashDOT director, who apparently, and I didn't know anything about him until this comment told me, that he worked for Smart Growth America and helped develop the Portland streetcar. Do you have any thoughts about Roger Millar at all?
I don't have any thoughts about him. I mean, I guess in retrospect, it makes sense because didn't Peterson come from Portland as well?
Well, Peterson also had that sort of alternative transportation background, bikes and so on. And I'm and that experience makes me not as excited about Roger Millar as I might otherwise be. So the hope with Lynn Peterson was that WashDOT's history of not really considering transit, bikes, and pedestrians at all on its big highway projects would somehow change. Mm-hmm. And that's not my perception. Now, maybe a lot of the projects that WashDOT is in were already well developed by the time she came in, but my perception is that 520, I mean, there's a bike lane, which I shouldn't ignore, but the 520 is still going to be kind of a bad situation for transit transfers, that these things are still unwalkable, that when we do construction projects on I-90 or on 99, no one really cares about the bus lane. Mm-hmm. You know, so all these pathologies are still there. And then furthermore, I think we said last time that the big problem with the big ticket WashDOT projects are by design brought in from the executive and the legislature rather than anything specific at WashDOT. So I think that's a push for a WashDOT director. But in terms of managing implementation, I don't know that a bike advocate is necessarily any better at project implementation than a road warrior necessarily. And so
this kind of goes back to your question, or I guess your comment, when we were talking about the appointment of the new Sound Transit, Peter Rogoff at Sound Transit, mm-hmm. which is the degree of an actual individual executive to leave their imprint on something is limited compared to the legislative and political forces kind of shaping their work and shaping their, you know, their agenda.
And of course, Portland streetcar being a mixed traffic streetcar is kind of a double-edged sword for a lot of transit advocates, but, you know, I mean, look, I'd much rather have a WashDOT director who's excited about bikes and excited about alternatives to driving than not.
Right.
And that's clearly the case, but I'm not sure that he will be a successful WashDOT secretary, especially in the current environment. But, you know, it's better to be an advocate than not. So yeah. I guess that's all I have to say about that.
So let's ask, Zach L. asks about uptown upzones. So this is a proposal to, I just looked at it. I actually hadn't spent much time looking at it before this, various proposals to upzone around Seattle Center, which is now on the docket for the city of Seattle.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of this either, so I don't have any special insight on this particular fight, although I don't understand why the forces for or against it would be really any different than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But I would say that you should probably contact your council member, particularly if they're on the land use committee. And if you live in Uptown, then your opinion is especially important, and you should show up to meetings to counter the NIMBYs who will be there.
I mean, it's interesting, the context of Seattle Center, right? I mean, a lot of times these arguments are like, well, there's no green space, which would be a really hard argument to make in Seattle Center, although I'm sure people will try to make it.
Oh, I mean, there doesn't have to be any grounding reality. there's always something to fear. But, you know, and I would say that, you know, rather than just showing up to meetings and commenting, if you are an Uptown resident who's in favor of an upzone, which you should be, then form an organization, Uptown for Upzones or something like that, and like say, I'm representing Uptown for Upzones, and maybe it's just five of you, but like forming an actual organization and going and lobbying council members and showing up to meetings and mobilizing people and getting a mailing list going.
Getting colored t-shirts, apparently.
That's getting it. Colored t-shirts is how change happens. So that would be my action alert, is like start finding like-minded people. I don't know if Zach lives in Uptown.
Yeah.
If he doesn't, then he is considerably less leverage here. But still, he has a council member who's going to vote on this thing, and he should let his three council members, be with the two at large, they're going to vote on this thing, and he should let them know what he thinks.
I think there's potential good stuff there. Yeah, it's good to know.
Okay, Gondola. We should actually investigate and write about that upzone some. Okay, but moving on to gondolas. So we used to have a staff writer, who Matt Gangemi, who is kind of the patron saint of Seattle gondolas. And some people sort of dismiss them as silly, and I think that's a real failure of imagination, since you have to go to far off Portland to see a gondola that works pretty well, as far as I understand it.
Yes.
So it's not really an outrageous thing to do. It doesn't seem to ever get any traction for anyone who has any influence or power in Seattle. And, you know, I mean, there, because of our topology, there's some interesting places to do it. This was often considered as an alternative to the Metro 8 subway. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, I think the nature of these gondolas is that you would have fewer stops than you would ideally have in a transit line. And furthermore, with the way ST3 is going, it looks like, as we've mentioned before, I think the Queen Anne to the lower Queen Anne or Uptown to Capitol Hill route is pretty well covered. So I don't know if this thing's day has passed without really ever happening.
Yeah, it might be. I think it's kind of the sun is setting on the gondola dream, especially as South Lake Union buildings get taller and nobody really seems to have a plan for where the gondola is going to go in the right of way and that sort of thing. But I mean, I think, yeah, if you're right, if there's one corridor, it's Queen Anne to Capitol Hill through South Lake Union, where a gondola would actually make a lot of sense, a stop in South Lake Union. They don't have the highest capacity, right? I mean, even a, you know, it kind of depends on the size of the gondola, but I think you're only talking a couple thousand riders per hour, which at rush hour, I don't know if it's enough.
I'm not sure that's right. I think it's more than you think. I mean, you could put eight people in a gondola car, I suppose, and you could have one, you know, three or four of them a minute, right? Is that possible?
I don't know if you can do that.
Probably two a minute. So that's 16 times 60. Yeah, it's only 1,000 people an hour. Right. Yeah, and maybe those numbers are wrong. I don't know. But
yeah, but that's I think it's in that ballpark of a couple thousand an hour, which, you know, depending on it's not the end of the world, but I think we're looking at higher capacity stuff for
yeah. So I mean, I'm open to it. I think with all the water in the hills we have, I think there's probably more than one place if you had sufficiently dense nodes in the future. that you want to look at something like
this. There was one, a privately funded one that was proposed for Union Street, right, a year or so ago. Is that still happening?
I don't think so. That was by the guy who built the Ferris wheel. He wanted to run something down from the convention center, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
To his Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anything about that in a while. I don't think that's going to happen. With the way the monorail tried to get through downtown was slayed for that, I just don't see it as a likely thing. But like I said, with the hills and the water, if we had some dense nodes that where you wanted to connect, I think a gondola is not a crazy way to do it. But we actually lack dense nodes in a lot of those places that we're not going to cover with rail. So
right.
I'm open to it, but I just don't see in practice any real drive for it. And secondly, not any real compelling cases anymore, given that we're already going to do these other things.
Joe wants to know. Joe has a couple of questions, but I'm going to pick one, which is, what does Bill Bryant or any other Republican need to do to earn your endorsement?
Well, as one person out of four on the editorial board, repudiate almost everything he said about climate change and transit up to now. Jay Inslee has not done. Jay Inslee has been great on transit. He's been good on. He's been stymied, but I think he's absolutely been trying to do the right thing on climate change. And he has a bit of a fondness for highway widening that I don't like at all. As I understand it, Bill Bryant does not want to do anything about climate change, has no interest in getting more funding for transit, and also wants to take away right away from transit on I-405.
Right.
So he's got some work to do to be better than Jay Inslee. A lot of work to do.
Yeah. If he could convince us that he'd be credible on any of those issues, I think that'd be something. What else do we have? Oh, streetcars versus trolley buses. Michael wants to know, leaving aside aesthetics, what are the advantages to streetcars?
I think there are some. I think we've mentioned this before. So, one thing is, although this is not as we mentioned last time, this is not as much of a benefit as I thought it was, but I think boarding with wheelchairs and strollers and stuff is a little bit better in practice, even with the, the good low floor buses. But I think the real big benefit besides, like you said, aesthetics, and there's the smooth ride, I suppose. Before I get to the big thing, there's also the issue of whether or not it encourages development. And I think the jury's out on this to some extent. I think it's a pretty positive indicator when companies like Vulcan are willing to ship in money to build the streetcar. It's some indication it does actually help with development, unless they're just being very foolish with their money, which could be the case.
Right.
People say it's just a development tool. Rather than quote unquote real transit. But let's do a thought experiment. Let's say we have five corridors in the city that are kind of sprawly, like Aurora type corridors. And we can either build buses on five of them, good buses on five of them, or a streetcar on one of them. And in this model, streetcars are really good at encouraging density and the buses are not, which is kind of the assertion that you would make here, right? Then in 20 years, you will have a very awesome, dense corridor in one place with a streetcar, and you'll still be in strip mall land in the bus model. So, that's part of building a good transit city, right? That's not just development. That's a big deal. I think that jury's out on that, on whether that's really, there's such a big difference. But there's some good circumstantial evidence that it is. But the big difference that's more concrete is that the driver is hermetically sealed from the, at least in practice in Seattle, the driver is hermetically sealed from the passengers, which they're not on a bus. And that is important for two reasons. Number one, no one uses the driver for a trip planner. And number two, it forces you to do off-board payment.
Right.
Like with Rapid Ride, it was supposed to be off-board payment. you can always have the driver take care of it if you need to, and you eventually fall back on that. But with this big door, this big gate, that option is removed. And so they decided, you know what, we're just not going to collect fares if we can't get the off-board payment right. That was the decision in Salt Lake Union. And that's great. Like, I think that's a big deal. Now, on the other hand, streetcar opponents make a big deal of the fact that it cannot go around obstructions in the lane as effectively as the bus. And that's true. That said, I think, you know, if they were going to be the same cost because of some sort of matching grant or what have you, or a federal program, I would take the streetcar. I think those pros outweigh the cons. Is it worth additional money? Assuming that you could reprogram money to do something like build those four extra bus lines instead of just do nothing with it. That's a difficult question, and it would be hard to say for sure as a blanket statement. Mm-hmm. But to answer his question, yes, I think there are some advantages.
I think it has to be on a useful line. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see a lot of development along the First Hill Streetcar that we wouldn't have seen otherwise along that line.
Yeah, the First Hill Streetcar is a case where, as you said, the development potential is not very high.
And you're also running into an issue of inflexibility in the, I mean, you've got, it's a mixed traffic streetcar, and it kind of can only be a mixed traffic streetcar because of the kind of crazy alignments that they had to do on Broadway to fit in parking and general purpose traffic and turn lanes and a bike lane and and everything else. It locks you in.
Well, I was reading a book about street stuff, and actually I was wondering, if we made Broadway one way, would that solve the problem?
I don't know.
Something to look at.
That's interesting.
Because I don't think you can really cut out cars completely, but I wonder if going one way, at least for cars, would solve the problem. Anyway, we have to figure that out. Maybe someone is very familiar with the layout of Broadway.
So let's do a couple more. Let's do one or two more of these. What can Congress do to help TOD and mass transit? I thought that was an interesting question. I mean, Congress has generally been pretty skeptical of funding TOD and mass transit. I mean, the thing they can do is, you know, raise the gas tax and direct a lot of money towards transit. I mean, there's a lot of things they could do. I mean, realistically, what can happen? A lot of it, I think, happens more at the executive level. I thought, you know, there was an interesting partnership soon after Obama came into office between HUD and the DOT. So it was this kind of joint sustainable communities initiative where they basically got together. I think it's where the Tiger grants come from and a couple of other of those kinds of grants that are basically directed at communities for investing in kind of livable communities and alternative transportation and things like that. They've given out a few billion dollars over the years. It's, you know, which is pocket change for the federal government, but a fairly nice amount of money for these kinds of things. And that, I mean, to me, that seems like what the federal government can do best is act as a kind of counterbalance to other local funding sources and say, hey, we're going to come in and make you do this, and or we're going to reward you if you do this.
So imagine that Congress was really interested in doing this, which they're not. You could very easily tie New Starts grants, which are big chunks of money, to up zones. So, I mean, that would be a very nice stick to say, look, we're putting this light rail line, and there better be like a Vancouver-style upzone around it. And then, you know, the local government has to say, look, if you want light rail, you have to have – I'm sorry, this project isn't going to happen unless we have very tall buildings.
Right.
And that would really kind of short-circuit a lot of the hyper-localized politics that are keeping us from achieving any goals. That would be nice. And so the question was, besides more funding, and I think you're right, like, you could also make driving less desirable through raising the gas tax, through changing some of the tax treatment of parking and some other things.
Do you want to maybe do one more and then we can kind of call it? I'll let you pick the last one.
Okay. Here's one. So, Adam S. asks, should social justice be a consideration in choosing between Alaska, California, and Delridge routes? So, for West Seattle Light Rail. So, first of all, it is a consideration, at least formally, in Sound Transit's corridor evaluation process. They're considering access to minority and low-income populations. But I think this is kind of, I mean, this is kind of a double-edged sword. There's this idea, I mean, there's two competing things. There's this idea that, you know, that low-income people are more transit dependent and really need high-quality transit service for a lot of reasons, which I think is true. But there's also the idea that light rail, because it's an improvement in the neighborhood, will bring gentrification. And because our zoning is restrictive, gentrification leads to displacement, which is the actual problem. I don't think gentrification is essentially desegregation, which is, right. I mean, I thought it was good, but displacement is not good. So, you know, I think it ideally would be a consideration, but I think social justice advocates should decide if they want high quality transit service that improves the neighborhood, or they want to prevent gentrification, and then stick with that story. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to get some, inevitably, if you build light rail down Dell Ridge.
Right. Yes, although I guess you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's an interesting question to try to think about in a 20 or 30 year time frame, right? Like what is, or 15 year, 20, whatever it's going to be, what are the developing neighborhoods going to be in that timeline? Are they still going to be the same neighborhoods they are today? How is that going to change? It's a hard thing to kind of look that far out and figure it out. I think you also have to look at transit-dependent populations and all-day ridership, right? So you can talk about social justice, but I think another way to just talk about it is to say, look, where are there going to be people who are dependent on transit are going to ride it a lot, right? And are going to ride it all day and benefit from high capacity fixed infrastructure, right? I mean, if, you know, mm-hmm. And this kind of,
well, I mean, to be contrarian again, you can take it the other way, right? You could say, look, a captive transit dependent population is already riding the bus. And so you're not going to win any new riders. Whereas a choice rider may be attracted by really high quality rail.
Right.
I mean, certainly if it were a business that was seeking to maximize its profits, you would do the exact opposite.
Right. 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 No, that's true. Although unfortunate, but yes.
Yeah. Maybe that's reprehensible, but yeah, I might as well be contrarian because otherwise this is very boring.
Right. 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 No. Well, yeah. I mean, if your goal is to, I mean, yeah, your one goal would be to kind of try to get new riders into it. But the other thing is like, you could really juice your system by, I mean, if Sound Transit could call, you know, if they sucked all the riders from Metro, you know, their system would be very successful. They'd be happy with that. But that's neither here nor there. No, I do think obviously this needs to be a consideration, but we need to understand that you're right. We need to figure out if light rail is going to come, how are we going to deal with those effects, and what do you want a neighborhood with light rail in it to look like? And are you okay with the fact that there's going to be some amount of displacement? And how are we going to minimize the displacement? Are we going to minimize the displacement by trying to just grandfathering everybody in there who currently lives there, or by finding ways to accommodate the more people who are going to want to live near a train station? All right. Well, that'll kind of do it for this week, but we managed to kind of sneak up against an hour again. But we will, if we didn't get to these this week, we'll try to get to them next week. Otherwise, kind of leave some more questions in the comments when this posts. This is, I don't know if you said it, but today's Leap Day, February 29th. We'll probably be posting this in the next day or two. So, all right. I'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks, Martin.
All right. See you then, Frank.